This is Michael Woodward, and this is episode 26 of the JumbleThink podcast.
T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
On today's episode, we have Tim Laskus. Tim has his PhD in clinical psychology. He's written books. He's a podcaster. Really cool guy. Excited to have him on this episode. It is so much fun doing this podcast, but I'm here to ask you for a little help. I want to get more people listening to each episode, and the best way to do that is have you share it with your friends, your family, and your coworkers on your social networks, whether that's Facebook or Instagram or Twitter, whatever you're on. Share a link to jumblethink.com and let people know that you're listening to this podcast and you think they should listen to it too. Now, let's jump into my interview with Tim Laskus. As I mentioned in the intro, we have Tim Laskus on today's show. Really cool guy. He has his PhD in clinical psychology with an emphasis on organizational behavior. In the episode, Tim shares what that means and also a lot about his journey on overcoming crazy obstacles to become who he is today. He works with tons of businesses. He's an executive coach. He works with tons of professionals, mental skills coach with some of the world's finest pro athletes, especially in the world of motocross. He also hosts a really cool podcast and blog. He's written a book called Finding Your Costa Rica. There's a really cool story behind that. And the premise behind the book itself is awesome. So you're going to want to check that out too. And we talk a lot about that in the episode. Well, instead of listening to me talk about who Tim is, let's jump into my interview with Tim Laskus. Tim, it is so much fun to have you on, getting to know you the last couple weeks. And you're such a cool guy and you got lots of cool stuff going on. So welcome to the show.
Hey, Mike, thank you for having me. You know, you're taking a risk putting me on your show, just to let you know.
Oh, I don't know about that. I mean, you might rank up there as one of the most interesting guys in the world, for sure.
Well, thank you. I'll send you a check later.
Well, tell us a little bit about you and what you're doing.
Yeah, well, I am a trained in psychology. I hate to say psychology. Whenever I say psychologist, people are like, ooh. You know, they either one or two things happen. They say, well, you can either, you know, read my mind, which no, I don't. Psychologists don't read your mind. And or they just start laying on you all their problems. But no, I have a PhD in clinical psychology with an emphasis in organizational behavior. I have a background in doing executive coaching, organizational consulting, life coaching, written one book called Finding Your Costa Rica, which I'm sure we'll get into what Costa Rica is all about and how that's important in my life.
Yeah.
I'm also an adjunct professor where I teach other individuals who are in a graduate program how to be therapist. And I am a new podcast host of the Tim Laskus Show. And so that's kind of been my new little passion and my baby going forward. So, and did I mention professional? I'm a mental skills coach with professional athletes as well.
Wow. Yeah,
I do all these little things, you know, it's just my wife says, you need to slow down.
Well, it sounds like you might at least need to take a nap or some sleep time for sure.
Yeah, my three-year-old let me.
There you go. I get that one. So what is an organizational behavior specialist? What does that mean?
Yeah, organizational behavior basically is the psychology of people within organizations when they get into groups.
Okay.
There's a whole specialty. We have actually organizational behavior, you have organizational development, you have industrial organizational psychology, which is more of the statistics and people who have factories and, you know, they're producing so many widgets an hour. So an industrial organizational psychologist would go in there and figure out how they can, you know, best produce more widgets, where an organizational development or an organizational behavior psychologist is more into the people side of business, the psychology within organizations. And when people get together and the work workplace, kind of unique things happen. And we've all been there. We've all had some crazy coworkers, or you know, maybe we were the crazy coworker. So, you know, a lot of it has to do with helping organizations maybe manage motivational issues. Maybe there's a lot of like low morale within the company, or maybe there's the grapevine kind of impact that's really negatively impacting what's going on. Things like that also has to do with leadership and development and managers and supervisors and helping them to do a better job in their position. A lot of times people get promoted because they're good at their job, and they get promoted into a supervisor or management position, and it doesn't really kind of mesh well because they were good at their job. They weren't necessarily good at working with others. And so when people take on those titles as a manager or supervisor, that's what they think they have to do. They need to manage people. They need to supervise people because that's what they're getting paid. But that just pisses people off. So you have to help them understand, what does it mean to be a leader? And how do you build people up to get them to produce whatever it is you need them to do? Instead of, a lot of times, the opposite happens. New managers or supervisors will go in there and rip people, just kind of tear them down. And they think, you know, if I just stay on this person enough, they're going to end up just kind of, you know, understanding what I need, and they'll do it. Well, no, that's not what happens. They end up resenting you and hating you, and they do all these things behind your back that set you up so you'll be the one fired. So there's a lot that goes on in organizational behavior, for sure.
You're doing all these different things, and somebody from the outside might look at you and say, well, this guy's got it all together. He's super successful. He does the psychology. He's you have this commercial building service that you've had. You've written a book. You're working with athletes. You've got a podcast. You've got a YouTube channel. You've got, you know, you're traveling all over the place. This guy has everything. All the ducks lined up, everything's perfect, nothing ever goes wrong, but they don't know your backstory of how you got there. You didn't have an easy journey to where you are today, did you?
No, not at all. And in fact, I was voted in high school as the one who would be most likely to fail in life.
Wow.
And people don't believe this story, but it's true, and I'm going to have to get a copy of my high school kind of transcript to show, but I graduated in the back of my high school class, and I barely graduated at all. Teachers just kind of passed me through. And I remember I was taking one of my math classes. And I just couldn't do it. And the teacher just sat me in the corner and just let me, I just did other stuff during class and they just passed me. This was a product of the public school system in South Carolina. But, you know, if anybody gets upset about that, hey, it's the truth. There are a lot of schools. There are some schools that are good. But
yeah,
let me tell you, I just got passed through. A lot of it was me, and my parents didn't really kind of focus on education. The school kind of, you know, left me behind and didn't do their part. I also, you know, didn't do my part. I never studied, never did anything. I was into racing motocross all throughout high school and even into my 20s. I was an amateur motocross racer, and I thought at one time maybe I'd do that for a living, but I wasn't really that good. And so when I barely graduated from high school, my dad said, all right, now what are you going to do? If you're going to stay home, I think you need to maybe do something. You know, where are you going to go to college? I'm like, Dad, have you seen my transcript? Really? Nobody is going to accept me. And he said, well, you need to go right down the street to that community college and sign up. And so that's what I did. And I took some courses. I passed them. I took some and I failed them. And education just did not come easy. It was a mystery to me. I never really fit in kind of anywhere. You know, I wasn't really a jock. I was good at racing motocross, but I was terrible in all the team sports. You know, I tried football and baseball and soccer, and I was a good bench warmer. So, wow. I was kind of a failed athlete, you know, and racing motocross and spending a lot of time. I think that was the best thing that I did. Learned a lot about myself, but I didn't have to have what it took to be a professional in that. You know, academia certainly at the time was just you're miserable. And it was, it took me until I signed up for my first introductory psychology class. And I remember going into the class the first day and I was like, this is interesting. And I couldn't tell you why, but it was just something that sparked. I was like, I enjoy psychology. I don't know why. And I kind of got into it. I took the first test and I think I made around a C or so. And for whatever reason, I wasn't satisfied. Well, let me tell you, making a C for me in the before that, I was happy as could be. That was like making an A plus for most people.
Wow.
I was happy with a C because I was used to making, you know, D's and F's. And so I went to the instructor and I said, you know, I really love your class. I love the subject of psychology. I would like you to help me to be a better test taker.
Wow.
And this instructor actually took the time to sit down with me and teach me what it meant to study, what it means to learn material. Now, I grew up being told, study hard and get good grades, but no one ever told me how to study. It was just study hard. Well, what the heck does that mean, study hard?
Yeah.
So she was the first one that actually laid it out. Like, she gave me a blueprint of, this is how you study. People have different learning techniques and styles. Here's some of the strategies that, you know, it would be helpful. And so I went home and I adopted those principles. And then in the next, I don't know, a couple of weeks later, we took an exam. And after I took the exam, I wasn't quite sure. I thought maybe I did okay, but maybe I didn't. You know, it was one of those where I was like, oh, I just don't know. So the day that the exam was going to be given back, I came in late, as usual. And the teacher had already started the class. She was talking, and I had to walk in front of her, between her and everyone else, to get to the other side of the room. And she'd stop me, and she said, Tim, I want you to tell the class what you did. And I thought, oh, man, here we go. What did I do? And I'm like, I'm really kind of brainstorming. I'm like, oh, I don't know how to answer this. And she said, because you made the highest grade in the class.
Wow.
And I went, exactly. I went, wow. And then my next response was, whoa, there's got to be another Tim in here.
Yeah.
Could be me. And so I kind of had a smile on my face. And before I could even answer, there was a young lady up front. And she said, I've been an honor roll student my entire life in high school. And I cannot get an A in this class to save my life. And you can imagine, I was just so ecstatic.
Yeah.
And my ego, my self-esteem, everything just went through the roof. And from that day forward, I applied those principles in all my other classes, and I got my act together academically. When I had graduated at the back of my high school class, was it not expected by anybody to do anything academically for sure, or even, you know, just a minimum wage job and be successful. That wasn't in the cards either.
And now you have your PhD. So it's not like you just went to school, got your bachelor's and maybe a master's, but you've gotten the full gauntlet in the education world and been very successful in learning the skills to be a good learner.
Yeah, and that's what it was. You know, I went through school thinking I'm a dummy. You know, if I can't sit in class, like there were some students in my classes, and they would just sit and pay attention, and then they would tell me they didn't study. I don't know if they did or not, but they would come back to the test and just spit it out. And they just would get an A. And I'm like, I can't do that. So I must be an idiot. But it had nothing to do with me being an idiot. I never applied myself. And I certainly didn't have the techniques. And I didn't have a passion for school. So it wasn't until psychology that I had a passion. And then, you know, once I went to a community college, I transferred to a four-year university. Called Florence, in Francis Marion University in Florence, South Carolina. And so I started volunteering with in a day treatment program with adults who had persistent and chronic mental illness.
Wow.
And let me tell you, it was exciting. They had me just like one day a week going out playing basketball and, you know, just for a little bit of time. And I couldn't tell you why it brought me so much joy just to take these folks out and have them play basketball. So I ended up asking them, can I increase my day? So they increased it to 2 days a week, to 3 days a week. I was going several days a week. I was working for free.
Wow.
And I loved it. And let me tell you, folks, if you're doing something for free and you get a lot of joy out of it, you found your passion.
That's
what it's all about. And so that propelled me. I'm like, yes, I know I'm on the right track with psychology. So I ended up getting my grades up at Francis Marion University. and I applied to Rutgers University up in New Jersey, the state university of New Jersey, and they accepted me. I don't know. To this day, I don't know why they accepted me. I think that was a mistake, too. The God was looking after me. He did something. But I got in, and I said to myself, I am not going to let these people down. Whoever made that choice to let me in, I'm not going to let them down. And one of the first things I did was I chose a better group of friends.
Wow.
Because a lot of my friends in high school were fun. But let me tell you, we were all losers. We were like Beavis and Butthead. You know, We had lots of fun, but we were idiots. And so I made a conscious choice that I was going to be friends with the smartest kids in my class. Now, some people may sit there and go, what is that? And I'm like, no, this is what I did. And it worked for me because I ended up choosing my friends wisely. I didn't want to be the idiot of the group. So I studied three times as hard as everybody so I could make good grades. I ended up graduating from Rutgers University on the dean's list with honors.
Wow.
So I went from high school in the back of my high school class as an idiot to honors at Rutgers University. It's almost unheard of. It almost is. You have a better chance of winning the lottery because it just doesn't happen that way. But I don't tell people that to brag. I tell people that because if you put your mind to something, if you're passionate about something and you put your mind to it and apply yourself, there's nothing that can hold you back except you. And so I take that principle and I share it with all my students today as an instructor. And it really is, it was a powerful thing that happened in my life. And I felt like I needed to go out and share it with the world.
I think there's probably a lot of people who can empathize or sympathize or relate to that story, your story. And they may be going, I was counted out at a young age, and they may be at the place that they haven't had that light bulb moment. What might be some things that you would encourage them to do or experiments that they could engage with to help get that light bulb moment where they could find maybe something they're passionate about or open up the doors to their purpose in life?
That's a great question. And the first thing that comes to mind is to evaluate your internal dialogue with yourself. You know, we all have this internal dialogue of our own voice in our head, whether it's conscious or unconscious. Many times it is kind of the thing that holds us back if it's on the negative side.
Yeah.
I often believe we are all our worst, kind of our own worst critics. You know, that it may be a message that goes through your head like, you know, I've had a terrible life. I've just been dealt, you know, a bad hand. You know, I'll never get ahead. I'll never make money. Everybody else is lucky. Everybody else, you know, they were born into money or they were born to be happy or, you know, they have these great families. It just wasn't determined. It just, for me, you know, it wasn't in the cards. It wasn't my destiny. And again, that might be a conscious kind of voice that you hear in your head. I'm not talking about, you know, auditory hallucinations and psychosis. I'm talking about just our own voice in our head, which we all have. We all talk to ourselves, whether we know it or not, you know, and it might be a little pep talk like, okay, I got this, I can do this. But sometimes that little pep talk is a negative pep talk like, okay, you know, for me in high school, it was, you're an idiot, you can't do this. There's, you know, you're a failure. And because this was the messages that I was receiving non-verbally and verbally from others around me.
Wow.
My instructor that told me that I would never amount to anything in life. And then also their behaviors, the way that they interacted with me, kind of further cemented that I was a loser and I was not going anywhere. And so that really helped kind of create this negative internal dialogue that said I was going nowhere. And so what I would suggest to the listeners is to evaluate what is your internal dialogue. How full of negativity is it? Because every now and then, it's okay, we get down on ourselves, but man, don't wallow in it. Stop it when it starts and shift to something positive, regardless of something that maybe happened, maybe you had an accident one day. You know, you were driving, somebody ran into you, and you're going, oh, it's a terrible day. I'm a terrible driver. I'm an idiot. No, you can stop right there and you go, wow, that was a moment that I could have lost my life.
Wow.
I am so thankful that I'm here. I am so thankful that those other people are okay. I get to go home and see my family tonight. I think this is going to make me a better driver. You know, or maybe this is the opportunity for me to get a car that has more safety features. You know, so you can always flip the script instead of kind of going down that negative nanny road, so to speak. So that's the first thing, is to get control. Understand what are those negative thoughts you have. And if they're kind of, if you're just wallowing in negative thoughts, get control of it, stop it, and change it to positive. You can find positive in everything, because until you do that, you're gonna be stuck where you're at. And so the other thing is, what is it that you really enjoy? Make a list. Sit down and make a list of all the things that you enjoy doing, either as a hobby or even as work, whatever it might be. And don't really put much thought into it. Just make a list. And then go back and just kind of put them in order of like highest, okay, I love this the most, to kind of the least. And I would say, go through each one and figure out, okay, is there a way for me to make this hobby maybe into a kind of sidepreneur kind of opportunity while I work? Or maybe I want to go full-time into this, or maybe I want to get some extra training. Maybe I want to, you know, go take a class in this and further investigate this. So you have to start taking steps forward. And part of that is make a list of what it is that makes you happy, that you really enjoy doing. Again, for me, working in psychology and not getting paid, it made me happy. I didn't need to get paid. So if you need to get paid to do something, that's probably an idea, you know, a good idea that to not do that and kind of scratch that off your list, so to speak. So those are the kind of the two things that really come to mind, Mike.
That's really good wisdom and insight. And they're easy steps that somebody can take, you know, and it's not, I think sometimes we get overwhelmed by, oh, I've got to do all this hard work to get to a place of breakthrough. And yes, there's lots of work that has to be done, but you just gave two easy steps that can radically change the direction or outlook somebody has about their life, which is, it just shows that we've got to stop trying to make things so complicated and sometimes just go, this is going to be simple. I got to change my mindset and refocus on who I am and figure out what I'm passionate about. Just writing a simple list it's amazing. Those are such easy tips that somebody can start with.
Right. And don't be afraid to fail at an idea. You know, maybe you try something out and it didn't work, you know, but you still enjoy it. That's just a learning experience, and keep going forward and don't focus, you know, too much on, if I would have looked at everything I needed to do to get my doctorate, I probably wouldn't have gone down that road. It was a long, miserable road to haul. And if I knew what I was in for, I probably wouldn't have done it. But, you know, just look at what's right in front of you right now. What is the step you need to take to go forward? And only focus on that, because you can easily get overwhelmed. And maybe you think you're choosing a passion. Let's say that you think you want to go into cooking. Maybe you want to, you know, be a chef. And you think, yeah, I enjoy cooking at home. Let me go take a cooking class. So maybe you go take a cooking class and you decide, I don't think I'm really into it. But that's okay. Then you can mark that off your list. And many people go through several different ideas before they actually find the one that really hits home. So don't be afraid to fail, and don't be afraid to find out that, man, maybe that's not really my passion, and that's okay.
You know, making it a fun process of saying, I'm going to explore and just have many adventures. And these many adventures, these many explorations may open up to what makes me and what I'm to live to do. But maybe it's just a little side road of something fun to do and experiment and explore. And yeah, like you said here, maybe you go and take that cooking class and find out cooking's not for me, but I like doing it at home. Well, that's a positive. Now you've just found something that you may not want to make into a vocation, but you may go, something that I enjoy doing for myself. Or maybe you find that cooking is what you love and you dive deep into it. So it's, you know, changing that mindset into a place of, we're just going to have these little experiments, these little adventures, and I'm going to learn and enjoy through that process.
Yeah, life is a journey. It's an adventure. And something that I live by is that, you know, as far as I know, we only live one time. So my yeah. goodness, why don't you go out and seize the day? You know, just live life to the fullest and enjoy, because, you know, every day is a blessing that we're here. And why waste, you know, days, weeks, months, years just kind of wishing, oh, I wish I would have done this differently. I wish I would have, you know, tried that. No. And also remember, your past does not equal your future. It's what you do today that equals your future. Enjoy life. You only get to live once. Start living today. Start planning on what it is you want to do and do it. Forget about who did you wrong in the past. Forget about your failures. Forget about the people who did you wrong. Forget about that nonsense. Start fresh on a new slate. It's like taking a notebook and turning over to a new piece of paper. This is where you begin today. Stop wallowing in that kind of negativity of the past.
Now, you've mentioned a couple times in the podcast, and I've mentioned it, that you have worked with professional athletes, motocross athletes, other athletes, helping them with mental skills to really approach what they're doing at a high level. Tell us a little bit about that and what you do.
Yeah, this is a kind of an interesting thing how I got into it. Well, you know, I mentioned earlier that I raced as an amateur rider growing up. And so that's kind of really my connection to motorcycles and racing. And, you know, it was many years after I had my doctorate that I live here in Columbia, South Carolina. And I was just on the internet and I found this training facility that was about 2 hours away in Chesterfield, South Carolina, called Club MX. And I thought, wow, training facilities. I didn't even know they existed. So I looked into it, investigated it further. And I contacted the owner and said, hey, you know, my name's Tim. I used to race as an amateur. And I've got a, you know, background in psychology. And while I was getting my doctorate, in one of my internships, I had worked with a tennis player. And so I was supervised in understanding, you know, kind of how sports psychology works. And so a lot of the skills that I've been trained in to use in clinical settings work kind of go hand in hand. They're very similar in sports psychology. And I said, hey, I'd be interested in coming out and working with one of your guys for free. And if he likes it, then, you know, maybe we can work out a deal where I'll work with some of the other riders. So he said, sure, come on out. And so I went out there and I worked with their best guy that they had, one of their most famous and top name athlete. Worked with him for several months. And the owner said, man, we love what you're doing. We want to bring you aboard. And kind of the rest is history. And so I worked with a lot of the amateur and professional motocross racers there at that facility. The majority of them live there kind of year round. They range in ages from, I don't know, maybe 12 to like mid 20s. And they all live there in their motorhomes or RVs and whatnot. And then they travel on the weekends, especially the pro guys. You know, they're on a plane every weekend, and their teams will drive out their motorcycles and all their equipment in a semi truck, and so, you know, I will go out there right now maybe once a month or so, but I do a lot of work over the phone, especially with the pro guys, and at a high level as an athlete in motocross or any other kind of sport, there is a mental kind of edge that really separates the top athletes from the rest. You know, a lot of them can learn the skills to do something. Let's just take racing, motocross. You know, they can learn the skills to race. They can be in great shape. They can have the best equipment. But what really separates the guys who are making hundreds of thousands of dollars and millions from the guys who are just barely breaking even week by week is a lot of times it's that mental edge, being able to relax in a setting in which it is so intense. There is so much on the line. It's a dangerous sport. You know, people have died. People have gotten paralyzed. And as a rider on a factory team, they have a lot of stress from the factory itself to perform. You know, they're getting paid big bucks to go out there and pretty much win races. They have sponsors who are paying them a lot of money. They need to perform. They have fans who expect a lot of them. They have family and friends, and just everyone involved has these high expectations of them. And so right now it's the Supercross season, and during the Supercross, they set up these events in the football stadiums. So okay. Like they were in the Atlanta football stadium. They'll be in Giant Stadium. You know, they're all around. They actually even had an event in the Daytona Speedway middle of the infield. And so, you know, and then they pack those stands with thousands of fans, and they're televised on television, you know, so you've got, you know, millions of people around the world watching, and that's a lot of stress. And some of these guys just have never been able to get a handle on managing stress. And so that's where I come in, to help them to reduce that anxiety, to help them increase their focus. I do a lot of work with kind of like breathing, and breathing, a actually good belly breathing technique is something that can be used in clinical practice, but also used with professional athletes to help them regulate their breath, to bring their heart rate down, to decrease the amount of adrenaline that's running through their system so that they can stay as calm as can be. You know, a lot of times people get the misconception of professional athletes having to get all jacked up and ramped up. And you see football players, they're smacking each other on the head. You know, they're yeah. ramming their helmets into the wall, and they're like, ah! and that's okay for football, because they're, once they have a, you know, it could be maybe 5 seconds every time they snap the ball. You know, plays are really quick, and then they get the reset. But in motocross, in the main event, they're out there for 30 minutes. Wow. 30 minutes straight. You wow. cannot keep your heart rate up and you have an overflow of adrenaline and perform and be in the front of the pack. You have to be calm. You have to be cool and collected in order to kind of get, they call it gassed out. If anybody ever watches mixed martial arts, you'll see some of these guys who first turn pro. Maybe they're the one of the best in their gym, and they're good, and they're in shape, and they're great in jiu-jitsu or whatever it is they're, you know, their specialty is. And then they get into a main event, and 2 minutes into it, they just gas out. They're like, God, this guy is out of shape.
Yeah.
No, he's not out of shape. He allowed his heart rate to go up, to spike. His breathing patterns changed. And then all of a sudden, he gets that adrenaline dump, and he's out of energy. He's done.
Yeah.
So you have to be able to manage that in order to go through an entire, you know, 5 minute MMA fight or a 30 minute, you know, supercross or outdoor motocross event.
You said that there's like this line that divides elite athletes and regular athletes or even hobbyists. What are some lessons that the average Joe can take from this to say, here are some things that whatever I have to perform at an incredibly high level, whether it's as an executive of a business or whether it's running a race or whether it's riding in motocross, whatever that is, what are some actionable things that the average Joe could do to just increase their performance a little bit better, to make maybe the things that typically would just kind of shut them down a little bit, how can they overcome those kind of things?
That's a great question. And I think to be even more specific is, let's use, say, public speaking, or maybe someone has to give a presentation at their job. And many people have to do that. A lot of people are just, they get sweaty and clammy, and they're like, I don't want to speak in front of people. It just makes me too nervous. Well, one of the things that people can do is to not attribute so much to that actual activity, meaning, you know, don't start thinking, oh my goodness, I've got to perform. I've got to do this, you know, this presentation, or it's going to be the end of my career. No, don't put that much emphasis on it. Just go out and say, okay, what do I have to do? I have to do a presentation. Okay, develop your presentation, practice it, and just do it. Don't think about it. Don't think about it. Who's going to be in the audience? Don't think about, you know, your job depends on this. Don't think about any of it, because that just makes you overly nervous. So, And just like with the guys who go out and perform on the weekends, you know, on television in front of millions of viewers, I tell them, go out there and think of, like, this is just another day practicing during the week.
Yeah.
It's not a main event. You know, there's not $100,000 on the line. Don't think about that. Just think about it's just an average day, and you're out riding with your buddies, because it's that mind. Your mind will either play tricks on you, or you can play tricks on your mind. And so if your mind attributes whatever event it is, giving a presentation, as being scary, as being, oh my goodness, this is one of those moments where I have to perform, you know, that's when you're going to end up failing. That's when you're going to end up perform your worst. So don't attribute too much to it. Just practice it, figure out what do you have to do, practice it, and do it. And really don't think about it outside of that is one of the kind of tips I would say. And The other is anybody can practice these deep breathing techniques. They call it belly breaths. Many of us, when we breathe, we kind of use our upper diaphragm. And the way you know someone is using their upper diaphragm when they breathe is you ask them to take a deep breath in. And they do, and they go, and their shoulders go up.
Yeah.
Well, when you do a kind of a deep belly breath, your shoulders never move, but your stomach pushes out. So you're actually inflating that lower diaphragm. And so that you can practice on increasing the capacity. And you, when you increase that lower diaphragm, it helps to get the oxygen to all those areas of your body, your muscles, and especially your brain to help relax you. And being able to take several deep belly breaths in through your nose and out through your mouth. So it's in through your nose, hold it, out through your mouth. And you do that about 3 times. And many times people can feel when you do a really deep 3 breaths, you can feel light and tingly.
Yeah.
It starts to have an instant impact on your entire system. So you're changing your system physiologically just by breathing. And that will help you put you into a relaxed state going into that presentation. So again, the first is don't attribute too much emphasis on that activity. Don't think that it's something that you have to do. It's an important activity. Just think it's just an everyday thing. And then utilize those deep belly breathing techniques, and that will help relax you. Sometimes when people come into the hospital and they're hyperventilating and have a panic attack, they'll just give them a paper bag and they'll say, take several deep breaths into this bag. And they're able to regulate their breathing, and that panic and that anxiety and that stress will go away. And then they'll just release them. They don't really need medication. So that's my tip.
Again, such actionable steps that we can apply real easily. I love it. I love it. Now, in 2005, you decided to do a little adventure of your own. Tell us about that and what that was all about.
Yeah, it was probably one of the, I've had lots of moments in my life that were memorable, but this is one that I really cherish. Back in 2005, early in the year 2005, my brother was coming out to California. I was living in California at the time, and we would go on a surf trip every year. And so every year we would just kind of travel up and down the coast of California and camp and surf, and we loved that. But in 2005, he said, Tim, let's go somewhere else. He said, let's go to Costa Rica. And I said, Costa what? I didn't even know where Costa Rica was. I had to look it up on the map.
Yeah.
And so, and I said, man, I think they speak Spanish there. I don't speak any Spanish. He said, don't worry about it. I remember Spanish from high school. And he said, I'll take care of it. He said, let's just do it. I said, all right, let's do it. So we went to Costa Rica, flew out there with our surfboards, and we rented a 4x4 vehicle, and it was during the rainy season, and man, we went through the jungles four-wheeling. We had so much fun. We had mud. You know you've had fun four-wheeling when there's just as much mud on the roof as there is on the bottom. I mean that's we went everywhere in the jungles. If people who haven't been to Costa Rica, a lot of the roads around the coast are just dirt, and it's unpopulated beaches, not high rises and concrete like you'll see, you know, in like Daytona Beach or Myrtle Beach, which are two places I love, don't get me wrong, but they're just different.
Yeah.
In Costa Rica, it's where the mountains and the jungle just kiss the ocean. You know, they just meet right there. And it's just lush and tropical and beautiful. So anyway, we went out there and had a wonderful time. And kind of midway through our trip, we stopped in this little beach town, and we went into this restaurant. And my brother went to the restroom, and I sat at the table, and I looked over, and there was a young lady. And she was sitting by herself, and for whatever reason, I'm usually pretty shy, but I walked over and I said, hi, my name is Tim. I live in California. And I went on for about 5 minutes. And then she looked at me and she said something in Spanish. I don't remember what she said, but it was in Spanish because I didn't understand a word she said. And I thought, very good, Tim. She didn't understand anything you said because she doesn't speak English. And I'm like, gosh, man. So my brother comes back and said, John Paul, you have to translate for me. So we sat down, we had dinner. And then we went out and we just really connected. We clicked. We didn't even speak the same language, and we just connected.
Wow.
And so we went out and we went dancing and we had just a great time. And then I lost her before we were able to exchange our information. I looked for her for another day or two and I couldn't find her. And I happened to go back into the same restaurant where I'd seen her before. And she was in there looking for me.
Oh, wow.
And so we ended up, you know, exchanging our email. And so I took that email home and I found this, I think it's called Babelfish, which was a little website that will translate one language into any other language. So I type English in it and it would translate in Spanish. So I would send it to her. I started learning Spanish. I was watching those novellas, which, man, those novellas are not like our soap operas.
No, novellas.
Are soap operas, but they're really not. They're a lot more, they should be almost R-rated. I was like, what is going, this is on regular TV? But anyway, so I started going out there almost every month for the rest of the year, just visiting her for a couple of days. And, you know, at the time I was a, you know, psychologist. I had bought a house. I had two cars. I had everything that I had worked for, even had a dog. But I didn't have anyone special in my life. And so I just thought, man, I'd love this, this lady in Costa Rica. I think I'm going to go marry her and move there.
Wow.
But let me tell you, when I first told my family, friends, and colleagues, their jaws hit the floor. They said, you're moving where? You're doing what? You got this comfy job with a pension. You got a house. You got your car. You got everything you worked for. You haven't been out of graduate school that long, and now you're giving it up to move to Costa Rica. Are you nuts? I think you need the medication, not your patience. And I said, no, trust me. I need to do this. Believe me. I don't know. I have just a gut feeling. So what I did is I sold my house, sold my cars. I sold or gave away everything I own except a few items that would fit into a few suitcases. And in January of 2006, I was on a plane to Costa Rica, the happiest man alive.
Wow.
I no longer did I have to wait until Friday to start having fun. Every day was Friday. And it was the most liberating moment in my entire life. I went down there. My Spanish was still pretty bad. My wife didn't speak any English at the time.
Wow.
And so we got a little apartment in Heredia, Costa Rica, which is right part of San Jose, which is the capital. And we lived there for 9 months and had a fantastic time. We had all sorts of adventures, going to the beach, to the mountains, picking coffee with the locals, and just enjoying ourselves. And I was able to finish writing a book while I was there. I bought some land in the mountains, and I sold some land, made some money, and I started, you know, trying to do some coaching and just enjoying myself. And it was a blast.
Wow. And did that lead to writing the book, Finding Your Costa Rica?
I'd actually started the book, but I didn't have a title before I had left. But I finished my book while I was over there. And, you know, Finding Your Costa Rica just really fit, because finding Costa Rica, for me, it was my liberating moment. You know, it's finding yourself.
Yeah.
And how to be, you know, happy and successful. And that's how I came up with the title, Finding Your Costa Rica. And it was just a perfect place. You know, I wake up in the morning and I'd write for a couple hours a day and listen to the birds and just enjoy nature there. Costa Rica is just a special place. And, you know, we go back there several times a year to visit and just, I can't get enough. And my wife says that we're going to retire there. So that's probably what we'll do. But, but yeah, when I was there, you know, I would hang out with a lot of other retired, guys who were, you know, expats who are Canadian or American, and we'd meet at the coffee shop and we'd talk politics. And, you know, here it is, you know, I'm kind of the young guy of the group, and it was fun. It was a snapshot of what it was like to be retired. You know, I was just working on my book, and, you know, I had bought the land, and I'd go out with a machete and I'd clear some, you know, some grass and stuff. Cause over there, most people don't have lawnmowers. They hire someone with a machete and they cut your grass. And let me tell you, that is, it's incredible that they know how to work. And it was an eye-opening experience, to say the least. So
yeah, so it sounds like it was definitely worth taking the risk on that one.
Yeah, and one of my things, you know, as far as to the naysayers initially, was I don't want to look back. and say, wow, you know, what could have been? Thankfully, I took that leap. Thankfully, I took that risk. And, you know, my wife and I were married, moved in January of 2006, and we were married there in April. We're still married today. We have a beautiful 3-year-old son. His name is Landon. And a lot of friends and family and colleagues came down to the wedding. And there was, one particular person who was kind of negative about me going. And he came up to me after being at the wedding and meeting my wife and being in Costa Rica. And he says, Tim, he said, I have to apologize. He said, you were so right. He said, when I told you, you were crazy for going, he said, it wasn't you. He said, it was me.
Wow.
He said, it was my own fear of doing something so bold and coming to Costa Rica and selling everything. He said, I would never have the courage to do it, but you did it. And I was just jealous. And I was talking out of my own fear.
Wow.
And it was so powerful to hear that story. And it made sense why people did not really support me in the beginning, because I'm sure they were concerned about my own, safety and well-being and professional, life. But a lot of it had to do with them. A lot of it had to do with their own dreams that they never followed, and their fear, which is we could have a whole podcast on fear.
Yeah.
And how fear controlled their life. It wasn't that I wasn't afraid to go to Costa Rica. Sure, I was afraid. I mean, sure, I really wrestled with, how do I give up my profession, at the time, and everything I worked for, my pension, and, I mean, it wasn't paid into the system that long, but I was in the pension, program, with insurance and everything, and I just gave it up.
Yeah.
And I had to overcome that fear, and it was the fear that holds us back. And what I focused on more was, what am I going to look at, if I don't do this and I go and 5 years pass and I look back, will I be kicking myself? That's what I focused on.
Wow.
I didn't focus on, going over there failing and the fear of giving everything up and what it was going to be like. I got over that whole idea of, we need all these personal possessions. We can't take anything with us when we're gone.
Right,
everything stays right here.
Yeah.
So we get so used to having our possessions that we're afraid to let them go. And let me tell you, when I gave everything away, I mean, I didn't have a cell phone. All I had, I went out and bought a new laptop and took that. But I gave up everything else I had, stuff I had collected over the years, stuff that people had given me. And I just gave it away. And I felt so free. It's hard to describe that feeling.
Wow. Well, there's this great story of Frank Sinatra. And he, of course, lived the big life, the larger than life for most people. And he had this super expensive watch. And this was in the 70s. And this guy, he's walking to his car, and this guy walks up and he said, hey, it's so cool to meet you, but that is a super cool watch. And Frank's like, oh yeah, that's a whatever brand it was. And he goes, here you go, you can have it. And hands him this watch, and the guy's just like, whoa, what? So he gets in the car, and this person turns to Frank and said, why would you give up that? And he said, well, it's really a test. Do you own the item, or does the item own you? And where do you find your freedom? And it's just such a cool story relating to what you're saying. And I think that's really powerful. You're starting something new, the podcast. Tell us about that. Who's it for? What's it about?
Well, the podcast is called The Tim Laskus Show. And the reason that I came up with just using my name is because it seemed like all the really cool names were gone. And so I didn't want to have to fight anyone over, name rights and property, whatever it might be. And so I said, I'll just use my name. But I developed this show for entrepreneurs. And I wanted to be able to give back to people. Part of me getting into the profession of psychology is to be able to help others, to improve people's lives. And that's also why I read the book. Not read the book, but wrote the book, in order to give back. So my podcast is just an extension of the work I've done clinically and with professional athletes and in writing my book, is to be able to give back to the community of entrepreneurs, sidepreneurs, wantrepreneurs, and help people kind of break the chains of feeling stifled and locked into a job that they hate. And so I developed the idea to have an interview-based podcast where I bring on people from various backgrounds, from not only from business, but also from professional sports, since I have a connection to that, and entertainment. And so I bring all these people on with the kind of common thread of success stories in entrepreneurship, and everyone has something to offer, because I'd listened to a lot of podcasts that were just business-based, and a lot of them were very technical and just kind of lost me. And it was kind of always someone who's in business. And I thought, well, there's lots of people who have advice for entrepreneurs who aren't just maybe kind of, I don't know, in business itself, you know. And so I thought of, well, I have these professional athletes. A lot of the things they do in order to be successful also help entrepreneurs. And in addition to people who are entrepreneurs, or not entrepreneurs, but in entertainment, are also, you know, people have something to offer entrepreneurs. Like I had a guest who was on the Discovery Channel on the Bering Sea Gold, George Young. Wow. And I thought, man, who is like a better entrepreneur than a gold miner? I mean, yeah, they're like the original entrepreneurs.
Yeah.
I mean, risking their lives, and especially with Bering Sea Gold, they have to go under the water. They're diving in frigid water, and it's probably one of the most dangerous jobs on earth. And so I thought, this would be an excellent opportunity. And so I interviewed him. I interviewed the agent for Michael Jordan, Loretta Lynn, Willie Nelson. His name's Robin Lang.
Wow.
And he has his own kind of program that teaches people how to go into entertainment. And so he shared a lot of very cool stories of, you know, being with famous people, and gave wonderful tips on, you know, being an entrepreneur, you know. And then I've also had someone like Gary Simmons, who is a legend in the sport of motocross, who rode for many years and has his own DVD technique kind of system. And then he has an international training school. And so, you know, he gave wonderful tips. I interviewed Christy Arnett, who is a women's professional poker player, but she doesn't play just with the women. She plays with the big boys.
Wow.
And she brought a lot of great content and just value to the show. And so it really kind of solidified my, you know, my idea of bringing people from different backgrounds to be able to share their success and give tips for people who want to be entrepreneurs or sidepreneurs or kind of on the fence of, you know, they're a wantrepreneur and they haven't done anything yet. But just if I can help move people along to that next step, I'll be happy.
That's so great. Now, where can someone find you and learn more about the podcast, find your book, all of those kind of things?
Yeah, they can go to timlaskis.com. I'm on Facebook at Tim Laskis, Instagram Tim Laskis, LinkedIn Tim Laskis, and the podcast, again, is The Tim Laskis Show. It's on iTunes and Stitcher.
Nice. Well, we always ask with this one, or end with this one last question, and that's this. What is one dream you're still wanting to fulfill in your own life?
That's a great question. I would say for me is to be able to travel more and meet people from different cultures and different walks of life. You know, I've traveled some, and of course I do a lot of traveling to Central America, but, you know, I want to go to other places in Europe. And because I think that value that you know, a lot of people focus on, you know, oh, it's going to cost me a lot of money, or I get, you know, see something really cool. But for me, it's the people that you meet along the way. And there's so many countries and so many places to explore. I love just sitting down and talking to people and understanding their culture, their viewpoint on life. And I think it makes me so much of a well-rounded person. And so that's what I want to do, is be able to tackle more countries, learn more about different people and their cultures, because I can't get enough of that.
Well, Tim, it has been so much fun having you on the podcast, and thanks for sharing the wisdom that you've learned from all of your adventures with our audience.
Hey, thank you for having me. I had a blast, had a great time.
It has been another fun episode, and I'm really grateful for my guest, Tim Laskis, for being on the show today. You may want to connect up with Tim or find out more about what he's doing. There's a couple easy ways to do that. The first is go to jumblethink.com and find his episode. When you find his episode in the notes there, or in the episode notes, you're going to find links to his website and his social channel. You can also go to Tim Laskis, and Laskis is spelled LASKIS.com, timlaskis.com, and find out more information about him there. One of the purposes of JumbleThink is to help our listeners to chase their dreams. I want to hear how I can help you. It's really simple to do. All you have to do is drop me an email at hello@jumblethink.com. That's H-E-L-L-O at jumblethink.com. I'll respond to you directly. You'll be able to share what's going on, and maybe I can give you some pointers or some advice on some next steps you can do to chase your dream. Now, as always, I want to encourage you, find the thing you're passionate about, find the thing of your dreams, and create something amazing that impacts this world and makes it the world you want it to be.
Vous êtes une autre personne. Les mères de famille, les enfants peuvent également prendre un moment revitalisant dans quelques mois. Lorsque vous aurez bien saisi la technique et que vous serez maître de votre corps, vous pourrez vous décontracter même en travaillant.